There's a myth a lot of us grow up believing that hair loss is just a part of life. It happens. It runs in the family. And once it starts, there's no stopping it. But here's the truth. That's outdated thinking. Scientific understanding of hair loss has advanced in recent years. Today, we have a deeper knowledge of underlying causes, and we've developed science-backed solutions that are both effective and safe. And that's at the very root of Happy Head. Dermatologist-led innovation offering stronger, FDA-approved ingredients that work. But what really sets Happy Head apart is how personalized it is. They don't do one-size-fits-all fixes. You fill out a comprehensive consultation, and their board-certified dermatologists design a formula specifically for your hair loss pattern, goals, and lifestyle. And whether you're early in your journey or more advanced, Happy Head offers targeted options that actually work. Topical treatments, oral capsules, or potent dual-action bundles all delivered directly to you, discreetly and freshly compounded in the U.S. Most people start seeing results in 3 to 6 months. But the real magic? It's sustainable. This isn't just about growing hair, it's about keeping it long-term. So no, hair loss isn't inevitable anymore. Visit happyhead.com and find out what's possible when science, expertise, and personalization come together. Hair happiness starts here.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 356 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So welcome to the Outlander podcast, author Lori Benton.
Thank you. I'm really happy that you invited me to chat about Mountain Laurel and Diana too, of course, and all things historical and writing.
So before we get to that, before we get to the writing, I should say Mountain Laurel, which is what intrigued us to reach out to you. Of course, when we interview authors, or actually any creative, whether it's an author or an actor or a producer or a writer, it's anyone, we're really interested in kind of in their life in general, what got them started, what was like an instigator for them wanting to, or an impetus to get into some field or to change their life to do something or whatever it was. So tell us a little bit about your background, or how were you, is a writer something you always wanted to do, or have things developed?
Well, it's almost always something I've wanted to do. It dates back to the third grade for me. I had a best friend named Leah, and she was the first to write a story and showed it to me. You know, by that time I was already an avid reader, but I guess it had just never occurred to me that I could write a story of my own. So that whole notion just kind of burst my little third grade world right open. And so I was probably a little jealous that Leah had thought of it first, but I decided, you know, that's not going to stop me. I'm going to write a story. And I did. And I still have it. It's called Yellow Feather and the Wild Mustang. So I'm kind of still writing stories similar to that. But by the third grade, I had another passion too, and it was art. I've been drawing pictures of like my favorite cartoon and story characters since it's my earliest memory, so I guess as long as I've been able to hold a crayon. You know, and from the third grade, both writing and art were passions, but I landed with a really, really influential art teacher in high school. So after high school, I pursued a fine arts degree, and my end goal was to become a wildlife artist. And for a couple of years after college, I did do that, but then the writing bug bit again. I was in my early 20s by then, and I decided, let's see if I can write a novel, not just, you know, little stories like I had done off and on through the years, but a serious grown-up novel. So that's how it began, and I really had no formal training in writing, you know, aside from the occasional class that I might take at a writer's conference, studying stacks of writing craft books. But also since the late 1990s, I've had the privilege of sitting under the informal tutelage of Diana Gabaldon and, you know, other talented writers too. But Diana also happens to have this a great talent for teaching the craft of writing. And that's happened online at a literary forum that I think has probably existed since, I don't know, the late 1980s, originally only open to CompuServe members, but eventually it became open to everyone on the internet. And so I got on that thing as fast as I could.
I was going to say, when I looked at the blurb on the front of your of Mountain Laurel, I was like, how does one get Diana Gabaldon to read their book and then also provide a blurb for my book?
Yeah. Oh, Diana's awesome. She is one of the most generous people I have ever known. And so I'm just very blessed that she was, and it's not the first time she's done it for me. She also read and endorsed my debut novel, Burning Sky. So
one of the things that you were talking about when you talked about how you got kind of the bug from an early age by seeing what your friend was doing and being a little bit jealous, but then realizing mm-hmm. that you could do it too. That actually made me think of something, not writing per se, but I think it is two sides of a coin. One of the things Diana says a lot is that, yes, she's a writer and yes, she writes a lot, but she also is a voracious reader. And besides taking classes and learning and maybe learning about structure and the Lit Forum or going to school, you know, however, there's a myriad of ways of gaining information, right? Gaining tidbits, gaining knowledge about how to write. You're going to find, you know, 101 different ways. So many sources of information. Not all maybe wonderful, but there's a lot out there. But one thing that I have heard consistently by whomever is that in order to be a good writer, you need to be a big reader.
I totally agree.
You can learn things explicitly, but it does not offset what you will learn or osmote. Take in implicitly through, you know, just through the structure of the reading that you're doing. And so I want to turn the question around a little bit, and I'll ask both of you, you and Summer. So your friend was the one who had the idea, quote unquote, first about writing. What was the first book that you read that you remember, and how old were you when you read it, that turned you into a reader?
You know, one of them... Now, I had been reading for about as long as I can remember, so I won't remember the earliest, but one Christmas, and I might have been about 12 years old, my grandmother, who lived 3,000 miles away, so we didn't really know each other, but she sent me a book, and it was called Christie by Catherine Marshall, and it was a big, fat, probably the biggest, fattest paperback I'd ever had up to that point. And I just wasn't quite ready for that book. I set it aside, probably dutifully wrote her a thank you note and set it aside. And maybe 2 or 3 years later, I picked that book up and I read it. And I was just blown away. It was the first real meaty historical fiction I'd ever read. And that has always stayed with me. And I've always, I don't know, it didn't propel me to start writing novels then, but I think it was the beginning.
I would say it was probably, I think 12 is probably like that big age. Because mm-hmm. up until that age, I think we mostly read the things that were given to us in school. So none of the things really interested me. And I didn't know that reading could be anything more than textbooks and things like that. Or the juvenile elementary school style books they want you to read for book reports and things. But I recall it was either, and Ginger, you're going to have to remind me which one came first. It was either when my sister got a subscription to Harlequin Historicals.
Oh, that.
Or V.C. Andrews, Flowers in the Attic. And I know no one bought these books for me. I stole them all from Ginger's room.
So let me answer first. And then Summer can tell you if she remembers what one or which one. So when I, 12, yes, 12. So our, Summer may have actually been younger because we're 2 years apart. We're sisters and we're 2 years apart. So she would have, if she took it from my room, that would have been where she got it.
Oh,
so
it might have been 10.
It might have been 10, which makes it even more inappropriate.
Sure.
So my, no, you'll see why I say this. So it was absolutely V.C. Andrews came first.
Okay.
Which is not something I mean, these days I know, you know, people change, the world is slightly different and I get it. But it was, I guess mid to late 80s. And I don't even know, because no one gave it to me. I don't know if I saw a friend at school reading it and I was intrigued. And then I went and I just, God bless my dad. He's just like, if I went, you know, grocery shopping with him and they used to have, you know, like the magazine aisle with the cards and everything. And I would go through, and if I got a book as long as it didn't like look or appear salacious or something, you know, if I said, Dad, can I get a book? Like, you know, and I'm not asking for 20, just one. And his, you know, 12-year-old young daughter is reading. I mean, how great is that? My daughter wants to read. So he was just like, sure, Dolly. So I put it in, that's how I got so many books. Not bad books, not super.
Oh, I wouldn't call it a good book.
Oh, no. I didn't call it a good book. But I believe that's how I got the first. I know that's how I got many of V.C. Andrews' books, but I don't know how exactly. I don't exactly remember how I got the first one. But the first one I read was Flowers in the Attic.
Yeah. Like I said, I didn't know they wrote books like that until I read that book. I thought reading was boring and just textbooks and things that you had to do. And it became something that I wanted to do, which completely altered my life. So I guess thank you, V.C. Andrews.
And so it's not necessarily the content itself that has to, because obviously a lot of people get the bug by reading something completely different. But because that was so different than anything I'd ever read, I was like, oh, wait, what is this? And yeah. After that is what set me off for life. Like I didn't look back, and whether I finished that series, which I think I did, I went on to read the rest of the V.C. Andrews novels that I think by that time she had actually already passed. So
they were just kind of
churning out like the rest of her stuff again. But anyway, so that's how I got started. And then also, this I couldn't have done on my own because my parents were paying for it. They had to have paid for it because I was 14. As a freshman in high school, I did get a subscription to Harlequin Historicals. And it was, they had just started them, and I got it right when they started. So I had book one, and I remember book one was called The Yankee. And oh my. It was very light. It was nothing graphic or anything, but you know, it was definitely a romance. And so, and that one, and I read them all. I got four a month. And so probably cost $8 or something. It was quite an amazing deal, but yeah. So I'm sure Summer took those off my shelf too.
I did.
But wow. So it's so interesting.
And that reminds me that reminds me of the Sun. Remember the Sunfire, historical romances, So there was a line like that. It was Sunfire, and they all had their name. The title was the name of the heroine, Jessica or Caroline or whatever.
Oh.
And I did discover those shortly, kind of in that 14, 15 year age. And those made an impact on me as well. So those were my first romances.
And I think even though I kind of came late to the game, I don't think, well, better late than never. But I also don't think it's ever too late to find a book. I think that you find it when you find it. And I think that's always a good thing because it's reading. But I do wish I had found these slightly earlier. But I didn't know about Anne of Green Gables until I was 14 in high school. Mm-hmm. And I not just devoured the series, but like I went and found like The Blue Castle, Kilmeny of the Orchard. Like I had to have every single thing that she wrote about Avonlea or about, you know, that wider community on Prince Edward Island. So that's involved. Summer and I have involved a little bit of ourselves into your interview.
So I noticed that a lot of your, well, I would say, I say a lot of, but I was looking at your book titles, and a lot of them take, by a lot, I say a lot again, all of them takes place in the 18th century America. What drew you to that time period and that area?
That again was totally Diana. It was, you know, when I started writing, I had just, you know, we're talking about the influence of books. I had read a series of books, by Stephen Lawhead, called The Pendragon Cycle. They were set in, you know, early British history. It was Arthurian cycle, but it was kind of set, I guess, the Dark Ages, 500 or something like that. So I was all fired up, interested in anything Celtic, anything British, which kind of led to an interest in Scotland, which led to me finding Diana's books because, 1995 or so, I was in my library and I ran across an abridged audio version of Voyager when I quickly realized that, oh, this is the third and it's abridged. So we got to fix that. I read her series, which is only three books at the time. but shortly after I finished, something really monumental in my life that was life-changing, and that's not overstating it, happened. Drums of Autumn released. And that's the first book that is set in her series that's set in North America, specifically in North Carolina. And up until that time, I was raised on the East Coast. I was born in Virginia, raised in Maryland, but I never really felt drawn or that interested in American history. There was a lot of Civil War history around me where I grew up. There was that. But anything before that, nah, I couldn't have told you when the Revolutionary War was, didn't know. But after I read Drums of Autumn, that time period just latched onto me and it never really let go. So that's what drew me to that time period. And there was actually something, and this is kind of touching on how Mountain Laurel was inspired, but there was a specific character in Drums of Autumn, a very minor character. That really sparked my interest. He was a slave, a groom, I believe on a plantation near River Run, down on the Cape Fear River. And he's, even though his ancestry was African, he spoke with a Scottish accent. And I think I can recall Jamie and Claire being kind of surprised by that, but I was surely surprised. I was very much taken aback by that. By that time, I knew Diana on the Lit Forum. And so I asked her, I said, hey, did you make that up? Or did you find that specific thing in your research? And well, the answer was research. She had found it that actually is something that happened. And the reason is pretty simple. If anyone grows up hearing a certain accent, no matter if it's family or in that instance, a master slave, maybe a close relationship, maybe he was very close with the family. Well, that's how he sounded because that's what he heard. And, that just, the whole notion of that being born maybe of one culture, but kind of assimilating a little something of another and how that would work out with different people groups. Anyway, that whole notion kind of stuck with me. And so that's, you know, over a long period of time, I was kind of occasionally asking what if questions, you know, I mean, what if that was done intentionally? Or what if there were more than just one? What if, how many generations might that have gone on? And, you know, so eventually the idea and the characters that would become Mountain Laurel began to form.
I remember I don't remember the character's name, just like you, but I remember that instance of having the slaves on the plantation with the Scottish accent. And in my brain, I don't have a communique with Diana that I can just email her and be like, hey, Diana, why did you blah, blah, blah? But in my brain, I made it make sense because I thought to myself, if I learned English from someone with an accent, that would be the way I thought the words were pronounced.
And she did learn English from someone with an accent because we all have accents.
Yes, we do.
But you're right, Summer. You're absolutely right.
And I think I've said this on the podcast before, but when I was in Germany, I was an exchange student, and I remember the exchange students that had all been to the United States had all gone to different states. So even though they all learned British American English from a teacher who spoke with a British accent, when they were all in this English class together, the ones who had been to different states in the United States, one of them had a Texas accent because he had stayed in Texas for 6 months. One of them had a Brooklyn accent because he'd stayed in New York for 6 months. Like, it was just this melting pot of American accents in a German class in the middle of Frankfurt. So,
oh, that's so funny.
Yeah.
You're so thankful for what you had learned and challenged and researched, because it brought you, as you said, closer to the genesis of Mountain Laurel.
Yeah, you know, I am as fascinated with accents as I think it sounds like you are. You know, I grew up in a household. I was born in Virginia, but my mother's family is from Southern Virginia, Northern North Carolina, back to the 1600s. So pretty much Mountain Laurel is that side of the family history. Aside from owning slaves, I don't have no evidence that we did, but they were tobacco farmers and you know, or generally small tobacco farmers. And so I grew up in a household with my mother and my father, but also my mother's parents lived with us. Or actually, we lived with them. It was their house. But they were very much Southern. So my dad was from Minnesota. So I was getting both North and South in my house. So I grew up saying some words. I don't, you know, generally say them that way anymore, but I was saying some words Southern, just some, not all, you know, so I was aware of accents and differing accents from a very young age. So yeah, so I'm very fascinated with that.
Well, one of the things I noticed a lot in Mountain Laurel was that all of the characters kind of have different accents, and you have written kind of, not phonetically, that's not the right word, but you know,
maybe dialectically.
Yes. You have written dialectically for very many different characters. And how difficult was it to keep those straight and to try to write them in a way that really represented the characters well?
Yeah, it took some work and it took some refining, because I know, you know, a lot of people do, or readers do not like to read too thickly, phonetically spelled dialect. And, you know, so I wanted to give a flavor of it without, you know, making it such a labor to interpret it. But I love to read out loud, and I won't say that I'm that good at it, but I love to try on these accents. So I will read my work aloud, you know, dozens and dozens of times before I finally let it go at the end of the editing cycle, you know, when the publisher takes it away. So I hear them in my head. You know, that's one of the things I loved most about Diana's books when I first discovered them. It was the way she wrote the Scottish accents, you know, and they were varying. Some were thicker, some were more Lowland Scots, and you got your Highland Scots. But I could hear it. I could hear it. See, this was back in the day before YouTube, and we had easy access. You know, oh, I want to hear what somebody from Edinburgh sounds like. So I go on YouTube and I hear it. Well, back then, no. All you had was, if you happened to have a Scottish character in a movie that you saw, you might have got a Scottish accent, and it might have been good or not. Who knows? But so that's about all I had, but I could really hear it from the page with her writing. So that's kind of, I've just like kind of studied her in that way when it comes to the Scottish accents. But when it comes to the Southern accents, that's purely from my family background. Oh, and there's, I have a French accent in there, and I have some English, an Englishman, you know, so I just love playing with that. French is hard. French was hard for me. That's one accent I cannot do, no matter how hard I try. Can't do that one.
That's so funny you say that, because I do, and I'm getting into VO work, and I've taken, I'm currently in a masterclass with someone who does, you know, basically a different accent every month. And it's fascinating. And the funniest thing is I must have a mental block, but I found so far the easiest for me was the French. Now, French is my third language. So having a little bit more of, you know, maybe phonetic awareness, I don't know, maybe that's part of it. But the language I've spoken, other than English, the language I've spoken the longest is probably 20, however old I am now, 30, almost 30 years now. German has been, at least conceptually, it must be a block, but that's the hardest one for me to do, a German accented English. I cannot explain it.
I just like to pretend I'm Dr. Ruth, and then the German accent just comes right out of my mouth. But only if you're doing English.
I would have to just immerse myself for a little while in something. You know, there are some that come easier. Irish seems to just flow. Scottish flows. English is harder. Like doing the proper pronunciation of English, British English. I have a hard time with that. I can do Scottish or Irish much more easily. You know, why is that? I don't know.
Well, it is fascinating. And that's one of the things that I could do it, or so I thought I could, you know, do a decent job, not wonderfully, but, you know, get it across. But yeah, we did received pronunciation, and it was fascinating, because there are certain words, like, you think you know the accent, right? You think you can hear it and, oh, I can just mimic it. But then if someone gives you some text, like if I gave you something right now, would you be able to do it without having prepped? Because there are certain things that, like, literally, there's a finite list of words that are completely different. For example, certain words, not all of them, but certain words that have the short, long A, like the, or I guess the short A, the ah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the at, the short A, the at. Like, we would say dance, they say dance. But it's not every single word, and you have to, like, almost memorize it. So, yeah, it's definitely a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So you've kind of gotten into, through answering other questions, you've kind of, not danced, what's the word? You've kind of given us a little bit of information already about your, how you discovered, Diana, that kind of, that has influenced the your interest, or combined with your interest in dialects and your own experience with that growing up, influencing your some characters that you chose to write for or write of, and things generally around the cloud. Cloud's probably the wrong word. I'm thinking of like a mind map, like the topic of Mountain Laurel. When did the idea? So there's not really one time, right? Because like you said, it's your experience through your life. You kind of, the family history, as you said, your family history is Mountain Laurel. So what, or at least the time and place, when did you first have the itch that you needed to scratch about, I need to write something that takes place in this time frame that I'm really interested in and involving people that are maybe somewhat reflective of my own history, but also of that place and time in history? When did you first feel like that? And how did these ideas begin to germinate?
There's a long version. It's kind of a long and complicated story, because here's the thing. Even though Mountain Laurel is my seventh published historical novel set in the 18th century, it's actually the first one I ever wrote.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I started writing it in April of 2004. Okay. That's when I first set fingers to keyboard or whatever and started writing. But you know, the genesis of the story, it goes back years before that, pretty much back to the time when I stumbled upon that abridged version of Voyager, you know, 1995. And then, you know, as I've already mentioned, then Drums of Autumn released, I guess it was 96 or 97, somewhere in there. And I got on the forum. But by 1998, I was actually working. I mean, I had been writing all from 1991, that fantasy tome, I actually finished it, and I submitted it to publishers. Back then, in the Christian market, at least where I write, you did not need a agent at that time. So I was submitting directly to publishers, you know, and getting lots of very encouraging rejections. So at some point, I set that aside, and I thought, well, let's try something totally different. Let's do a contemporary romance. So, you know, 1998 rolled around, and I'm working on that, and I'm participating in the forum, and I'm learning the craft and everything. But then 1999, and I was 30 years old, and I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. And that just kind of put a halt to everything. 1999 was my year of treatment. I was not very far, you know, barely stage two. So I was fine. By the end of the treatment, I was fine. I was in remission, and I've stayed there ever since. Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine, but for one thing, there was a long-term side effect that I was struggling with, and it took a year or two actually before somebody on the forum actually clued in to what I was expressing about why I was struggling to write. I couldn't remember what I'd written. I couldn't remember what I researched. I couldn't remember my just everything. I just couldn't focus. They said, you're suffering from chemo fog, Lori. And I didn't even know that was a thing. I was never warned about that side effect of chemo. Well, chemo fog. That was just something that I struggled with for, years. I mean, finally, I actually just stopped trying to write somewhere in there, and just kind of just let my brain rest and focus myself creatively in other ways, until 2004 rolled around. I had basically got to the point where I thought, okay, I'm not going to be a writer. That's just, okay, God's got another plan for my life. It's not going to be writing. Mm-hmm. Bummer, but okay. But then, like I said, 2004 rolls around, and I'm still thinking about Josh. I'm still thinking about, you know, that character. And I probably had thrown some notes into a file at some point about, a character, a situation, a plantation, you know, something kind of like my, you know, family history. And so I pulled that out and began just looking at it. And before I knew it, I had Shauna. I had like the generation after that one who was, made to, in this case, made to speak Gaelic and everything. And I thought I could see this figure, this guy on a horse, dusty horse, coming down the road. He was the master's nephew, I think, you know, so little things like that. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to give this one more try. I'm going to see if I can write this story, whatever this story is going to be. So I kind of bore down on it. I started story weaving and plotting. And so by April, I basically had, I guess I'll call it a story situation. I didn't have a plot. I'd written in a linear fashion up until that point, you know, starting with chapter one and working through till you're done. But I had no idea what chapter one was for this. I had no idea where this story was going. I didn't know how it would end. One thing I knew, I could see a couple, three or four vivid scenes. And I also knew how Diana wrote. Diana does not write in a linear form. She writes what she calls digging where the ground is soft. And that is, you know, if something's really speaking to you, you got an image, you can see it or hear it or something, write that and figure out where it goes later. I thought, well, you know what? I could do that and see if that works. But really the point, I guess my main drive, my main concern at that point was make this fun again. Find the joy in this so that you'll come back and do it again tomorrow. And then the next day, and then the next day, until these flabby writing muscles could be strengthened again, because it had been years since I'd written anything. So that's what I did. I wrote whatever. You know, there is a scene with a raven in the book, you may recall. That's one of the first I ever wrote. So I just didn't really know what I was doing. I just was writing here, writing there. But eventually I started seeing a plot. And eventually I started putting the scenes in order. And within about 4 years, it took me 4 years, I wrote it. It took a couple more years to edit it. And I submitted it to an agent. And she signed me on the strength of that novel. And then it wouldn't sell.
Oh, no.
We couldn't sell it. So, but meantime, while she was trying to sell it, I wrote another book called Burning Sky. And I started another book called The Pursuit of Tamsin Littlejohn. And she sold those two books. But never Mountain Laurel until last year. Tyndale House Publishers finally bought it.
Wow.
And here we are.
Goodness.
It's a long and winding story.
It shows perseverance. You kept writing. You at least came back to it and you kept writing. Number two, that story was important enough to you that it had to come out through you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no one else could have done it, of course. And it's like it's not a little story. It's a good chunky novel, but it's like the story that couldn't stop, right? Because number one, I wouldn't say you left it, but you took a pause and you came back to it. But then when you got it done, it couldn't sell. But you went on, and then finally it sold, and it's the story that won't stop. You know what I'm saying? It's it won't stop you. You won't stop it. And even though it kind of rested on a shelf for a little bit, it was still meant to come out.
Yeah. And I, in some ways, I'm glad of the timing because, well, in writing Mountain Laurel, I absolutely fell in love with the 18th century. And that in my research, I kept turning up all these tidbits and just setting them aside in files, you know, I could write a story with that as the kind of the historical framework or spine of it. And, that's good too. Let's put that, you know, the lost state of Franklin. I bet you've never heard of the state of Franklin. I mean, maybe you have, but most people haven't. But it was almost a thing. It was almost our, 14th state. So my novel, The Pursuit of Tamsin Littlejohn, has that as the historical a spine. Burning Sky was about the Iroquois in New York and the whole aftermath on the frontier of the Revolutionary War and what that was like for both whites and the Mohawks and the Oneidas. And then I learned that the Oneidas actually sided with the Americans during the Revolution when all the rest of the Iroquois nations fought for the British. And I thought, wow. Okay, that's cool. There's a story there. What made them decide that? So that became the Pathfinder's duology. So on and on it's gone. But now I'm finally able to be working on the sequel to Mountain Laurel, which is called Shiloh. And I'm in the editing process now, and that will be releasing next fall, I do believe. I don't have a date yet, but I think it's next fall. But it also happens to be a sequel of sorts to Burning Sky, which I wrote after Mountain Laurel. I'm kind of combining those story worlds into a kind of a dual sequel. That couldn't have happened. It would have been a totally different book had I not written Burning Sky.
Ideally, they're all in the same universe. You haven't world built. You know what I mean? It's like you've placed your characters in a place that existed.
Yes, I am totally world building. I mean, I was a fantasy writer, so you can take me away from that, but you can't take that world building out of me. I mean, I'm totally world building. All my books are connected in that way. Even if it's just a cameo appearance of a minor character, they're all connected. So I could conceivably, you know, have any character that could fit the story from any other book wander in. You just never know.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because they're all basically in and around the same time period, near the same kind of area. So it would be very easy to kind of have tie in. I'm like, you know, like episodes where crossover
right.
books.
Yeah. Well, my previous book, The King's Mercy, that came out in 2019, you actually visit Mountain Laurel 50 years ago, in the 1740s. But because I knew that would work perfectly for that book, because I wrote Mountain Laurel all those years ago, I thought, well, you know, that backstory that I hint at, you know, when Hugh Cameron, the master, mm-hmm. was a young man, Malcolm, one of the slaves, was a young man, you know, it just fit perfectly. So I thought, let's just slip that in there, and that'll perfectly set up Mountain Laurel if it ever sells. And it did. It was the following book. So
other than Mountain Laurel, have any of the previous novels been had the chance for like a sequel, or is this the first like actual sequel you've written?
The Pathfinder's duology, that was The Wood's Edge and A Flight of Arrows. That was a case of one big story just expanding beyond, you know, the size of a normal novel. And I guess in a way, Mountain Laurel's done that too. You know, I won't give away the ending of Mountain Laurel, of course, but when I reached the end, I realized I could have made that ending very differently, but I felt like, you know what, these characters have a lot more story to tell, a lot more room to grow. I can end this one right here, but I think there's way more to this story. So if it ever sells, I will write its sequel. So very happy to be able to do that.
Yes, and I will say as a reader of Mountain Laurel, I look forward to finding out what happens, because although I understand choices that were made, and I think they were the right choices. First of all, it's your creation, so of course it's going to be the right choice. But I think for the characters, it reflected honor over passion, or honor over. The characters did the right thing, is what I'm trying to say.
Yes, yes.
And I know it was hard for all of them, but they did the right thing. So that is, to me, the best type of thing where you know that they did the right thing, but there's always going to be some pain involved with that.
Consequences.
There you go, consequences. And so
yes.
Because of that, you have like a, you know, you have, it's the push-pull, right? So I cannot wait to see or to read what the outcome of the end of the novel is, the outcome of not the fallout's the wrong word, but the outcome, the results of the way Mountain Laurel ended. I can't wait to see what happens in the next one.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Well, I can't wait for you to see it.
So regardless of what you work on, whether it's Mountain Laurel, you know, all those years ago, or the one that you're currently working on in the edits, what would be a typical work day? So for you, whether it, like, do you have a sacred space? Do you light a candle? Like I know Diana does. What do you do? What does your space look like? What field do you like to be in? Describe for us your space and that time.
Well, my space, I'm normally a very neat person, but my writing space, I work visually with notes. I have my monitor, everything is covered with sticky notes. I've got scraps of paper and notes and things, but it all makes sense to me. I can't keep notes on the computer, because if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. I'll forget they exist. So yeah. Books, I've got books everywhere, books piled up, books, you know, for the for the one I'm working on now and the one I want to be working on next. And but typically one thing that has never changed is my best creative time is the morning. So, you know, my brain's at its best from 9 to noon. So those are my hours that if I don't work anything else in the day, 9 to noon is what I want to work. You know, if I can get in a good 3 to 4 solid hours of writing a day, that's about all my brain is good for. But with that said, if I'm on a deadline and I'm feeling really pressed, what I will do is I'll get up at like at 3 a.m. or some ridiculous hour and then write until my husband Brian wakes up and he's getting ready for work. Which is way later than 3. So that way and then I'll still work from 9 to noon and probably take a nap. But that way I can get in some extra hours. But if I try to do that in the afternoon, it's so unproductive. It's just kind of a waste of time. Typically for the afternoon, I'm either off running errands or dealing with other things in life, or maybe I'll do promotional stuff or some social media. I'll answer an interview or do some research if I can stay awake. You know, so that's a typical day.
When you're deeply into that, like you have a hook or something and you're like, you're writing that 3, maybe 4 hours and you are not looking up, you're not taking a lot of breaks. Do you like to have certain snacks around, certain things that kind of make you feel comfortable? Do you like have a blanket on your chair? What makes you feel extra cozy and comfortable and helps you kind of get underway?
Well, you know, I wish that I was one of those writers that could play music in the background. I sit in an empty house with a quiet dog and I have to wear earplugs. I have to have completely block out, just forget myself bodily, forget everything. So I'm not snacking. I will have probably a cup of tea. I like tea. So I'll have some tea going, especially if I'm reading out loud, which I tend to do a lot. And so that's very hard on the throat. I don't know how audiobook narrators do it. I mean, that is a hard thing.
It is a hard thing. I've done a few books. It's a hard thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot. You can only go kind of like you, right? You can, mm-hmm. you have certain hours, what you're good at, or what you feel you're most productive. I have to work around, you know, my normal schedule.
It's tiring.
It is. And as far as your, and we talked about accents, that, you know, you have to prep your manuscript. It's just, it's a lot of prep before you go in. And then when you go in, it's I have to have water with me. I have cats that try to get in the room and make a noise. It's a pain. But yes, I can only probably record for like 2 hours, 2.5, mm-hmm. 3 hours.
Yeah. Before I couldn't imagine doing more than that. Yeah. In the winter, I like to have a candle burning. I don't know why not in the summer, but it's kind of it's a winter thing, you know, moody, rainy Oregon winter.
It sounds kind of like if you've heard the term hygge.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
H-Y-G-G-E. Scandinavian thing, isn't it?
Say it again.
Scandinavian.
Yes. I think it's Danish, but it's basically the term, and it's H-Y-G-G-E, pronounced hygge. Some people say hygge, but it's hygge. And I'm trying to see. Okay, hygge is, this is just Wikipedia. This is not scientific, but hygge is a Danish and Norwegian word for a mood of coziness and comfortable conviviality with feelings of wellness and contentment.
Oh, I love it. Well, I'm half Scandinavian, so I should know this word. I should know this word.
Yes.
So
you were doing hygge without even knowing it.
Not even knowing it. Yep. That's awesome. Oh, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Speaking of words, do you have a dictionary of 18th century things that people call things? Because I had to get the dictionary out several times while reading your book because I was like, shote, what's a shote?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I had to try to like, I was doing context clues.
A lot of people don't know what shote means. I'm not sure exactly. It's been so long. You know, like I said, it's been a long time since I wrote that book, but where did I find shote? I don't know. But yes, I do. I've got Scots dictionaries. I've got Gaelic dictionaries. I've got, you know, early American, you know, English. Yeah. Lots of stuff like that.
Kind of piggybacking off of what Summer just asked, do you have, besides dictionaries, do you have a favorite, or what are some of your favorite resources for the I guess collectively, since your writings or your novels take place predominantly in 18th century colonial America, what are some go-tos that you just like, that you could use for any book that you write pretty much?
Well, you know, it does, obviously some things change from book to book. And it's been a long time since I needed the general 18th century. But you know what? I like to keep reading novels that are set in the 18th century. I just constantly, I've always got somebody's novel going. So it stays alive. you know, in my thinking, and just so I don't have to stop. Oh, what was it called? That what was the lamp called? What was that piece of clothing called? You know, so that stuff stays alive with me. But I've got, oh, there's the whole Foxfire book. Series,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Yes, our dad got us into that.
Okay,
got into it.
That's a great. Those are great. They're all. I'm looking at them on my shelf right now. I mean, I've got a. My entire living room basically is my research library now.
Fantastic.
You know, the daily life on whatever the. I've got the daily life on the old colonial frontier right here. You know, just books like that. Just your. There's so many series like that. Children's books is a good one for like colonial trades, buildings. So when I'm researching a new subject, like for the King's Mercy, it was blacksmithing. That was a new one for me at the time. I started with children's books so I could just get the basics, and then I delved into more, you know, technical stuff. But I always love starting with children's books. For Malden Laurel, when there's a scene in there where a foal is born, I started with children's books for that, for pictures, because I've never seen a horse born, and I probably never will. So I started with children's books. So that's an awesome one.
Dr. Pole on National Geographic Channel. If you want to see livestock born, there is a good resource.
YouTube. Let me also mention YouTube. I mean, YouTube, you can find everything, anything, everything. There's people on there that are teaching accents, you know, so I've gone on there just like when I was writing, let's see, the Pathfinder series, the main character in the beginning is a Welshman. So that was so totally new, a Welsh accent. So I went on there to learn how to, you know, what are some typical things they would say, the little things you throw into your speech and, you know, speech patterns. That's the thing. I try to work with speech patterns more than phonetical spellings for accents whenever possible.
Who are some of your personal and or professional influences?
Well, you know, with writing, it's Diana and also Stephen Lawhead. But, you know, along the way, I also ran into Ellis Peters' Brother Cadfael mysteries. And Brother Cadfael is a Welshman. So they had a huge influence on me. I just love her writing. It's lush and it's gorgeous. For art influence, it was Robert Bateman. He is a Canadian wildlife artist. He's probably in his 90s by now, and I believe he's still alive, and I believe he is still painting, but loved his work, still do. Spiritually, my longtime pastor, his name is John Corson. He's been teaching through the Bible chapter by chapter, book by book. Now, I've been listening to his teachings first East Coast. We caught him on the radio. We actually moved to Oregon to be part of the church here. Just wanted to sit under that teaching. I was 17 when I first heard him. So I don't mind saying I'm about to turn 52. So it's been a long time. And, you know, he just has his rare gift for teaching the scriptures in a way that you can apply them practically to your life, you know, where God's truth can make a difference. And as an added benefit, I'm just pouring what I learn into my books. So if there's anything meaty or spiritual or you know, about God in my books, it probably came through his teaching and just his influence. So, you know, he retired in June. So, I mean, kind of sad, but it had to happen sometime, I'm sure. But, you know, he's still teaching. He's actually on his station is Searchlight, but he's on YouTube. It's like he retired, but he can't stop. It's because it's so cute.
That's kind of reflective of some of people with callings, right? It's like,
it's a calling.
It's very hard.
It's
not hard to necessarily stop a 9-to-5, but if your calling or your passion, if your 9-to-5 was your passion, even after that formal retirement, I personally couldn't see myself, you know, doing nothing.
Right. And I just can't imagine not writing unless for some reason, sure, physically or mentally, whatever, I couldn't, you know, but as long as I can, I want to, you know, I just can't imagine not at this point. I mean, because, well, yes, I can imagine it because it happened to me for 5 years, but I don't want to go back to that if at all possible. I get a lot of, it's hard work. Writing is the hardest creative work I've ever done, but I get the deepest joy out of it too.
So I know that you're currently editing the follow-up to Mountain Laurel.
That's right.
Do you have anything else percolating? Any other ideas? Like, do you ever have multiple projects kind of percolating in your head at once?
In my head, yes. But I don't have the ability that I know Diana does to bounce back and forth between them. I even find it a little hard to juggle writing a book and editing or slash promoting a book, because I want to get so absorbed in the story world that I'm writing that it's hard to pull out of that and remember the story, even if they're both 18th century, to remember the story world that is now being released and needs to be, you know, promoted and talked about. So I do have, I thought I only had two, but just within the last couple of days, I think I maybe have three potential story ideas to write next, and I'm just trying to figure out which one's going to grab me and yell at me the loudest to be written next. So yes, there are three more 18th century story ideas.
Fantastic. And you know, I never thought, I didn't put this down. I mean, it has to do with future projects, but right now, of course, in case someone finds this interview in a year or three or five from now, and we're, God willing, like super past this pandemic and back to a semblance of normality, whatever the new normal really will look like. Have you in the past gone on book tours, and would you imagine in the future doing something, maybe if not because of the delay of timing, maybe not doing a proper Mountain Laurel tour, but maybe for a future book, doing a tour for that book, but then combining books, since there was kind of a missed opportunity for everyone this year?
Well, interesting enough, I have never done a book tour.
Oh my gosh.
Just everything has been virtual. It's fantastic. All been online.
Oh, wow.
Or I've done, you know, podcast interviews like this and radio interviews. But it seems to me that from what I get from talking with, I've had two publishers now and talking with them about it, is that it kind of only works with the mega bestsellers that can draw a really big crowd. Yeah. So it's much easier. And I think you can probably reach just as many online as you can going in person. And obviously there's not the whole expense of the traveling, but you know, the more I do stuff like that, I mean, just going on a vacation kind of can knock me out of the creative zone for far longer than just the days I'm traveling. So I, just to protect the writing, which I really want to always be focusing on that. If I have to do one thing really, really well, I want it to be that, the writing, because then what's the point if, you know, other things are crowding in and so I'm perfectly fine with not going out and traveling. But with that said, I would be open to doing that. Yes, I would, if I was ever, you know, requested, and I possibly could do it. Sure.
Well, maybe if that, once things are back to semi-normal, whatever that looks like, even if it's not a full tour, and you know, definitely continue the virtual events, but maybe something at a local independent bookstore. That way you're not having to travel per se, but you know, if people who are local fans or even wider afield, it's less work on you in the publishing house if it's a very centralized to you location.
Are you interviewing to be her marketing?
No. No, I'm just saying, it's a lot of writers do that, but they don't have either, not even them themselves, although that too, you're absolutely correct. It is not something that every single writer does for every single book. It's usually, I don't want to say select group of writers, but it's the kind of the mega seller, right? Like mm-hmm. Nora Roberts. I don't even know if she does, but someone of that caliber, or Diana, or, you know, it's just people who are just have this ginormous following, right?
Exactly.
And even then, they don't do it every single time. But yeah, so and just curious, because I definitely am. I'm only sorry Well, no. Yeah, it came out because Mount Laurel came out in September. Mm-hmm. Did we already miss the virtual? Or has that, or are you still going to be doing something, a virtual event for Mount Laurel?
No, I mean, by virtual, I just meant lots of interviews going up here and there. Yeah.
Well, is there anything that you would like to share with our listeners that that you haven't been able to share yet or wasn't kind of germane to one of our questions?
Oh, we were talking about inspirations, you know, the things that inspire creativity, you know, and I think I did mention that I was originally going to be a wildlife artist and a painter, you know, when the writing bug bit, it happened kind of in the midst of our transition of moving from the East Coast to the West Coast. So I didn't have anywhere to set up for a studio. And I didn't have anywhere once we finally moved here. And I still don't. We live in a tiny house. So, you know, writing, but then also writing, it just kind of consumes. It consumes my creative energy and my time as a career. But, you know, painting became that way, too, when it was very, very briefly a career for me before we moved west. But something that happened a few years ago is I discovered digital photography and landscape photography. And in the Pacific Northwest is absolutely a gorgeous place to be living for a landscape photographer. And so what I found is getting out, you know, talking about just feeding the soul and absorbing beauty and letting that fill my creative well, getting out and hunting up these beautiful landscapes. I'm unplugging from all the noise, you know, of the world. And I'm just driving there. I'm listening to music. And all this time that I'm doing that, I'm kind of story weaving. So it's inspiring. It's filling me and inspiring me. And I'm probably jotting down notes whenever I stop the car. And discovering also with the digital photography how much editing you can do once you get that photo downloaded into your computer, it has brought the visual arts back into my life. And I just, until I started doing this, I didn't realize how much I missed it. So I wanted to mention some social media platforms that readers can find me on. And one of them is Pinterest. Not Pinterest, but Instagram. And that is where I post almost exclusively my landscape photos. I'll occasionally mention a little book news there, but very, very rarely. That's set aside for landscape photography. And I'm Lori L. Benton on there. But really, the best place to find me would be on my website, loribenton.com, because on the landing page, I've got all my social media links there, including, I did say Pinterest. If anyone's interested in a visuals, kind of a visual thing to go along with my novels, I've created a novel board for every story I've published.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Yes. Just pictures of I can never find anyone who resembles my characters exactly because I don't do that. I don't start with like a picture of a celebrity or a model, but while I'm working on the story, I'm constantly on the look. And if I find somebody close, they go in the Pinterest board.
After you've started, but then it continues with you through the process.
Yeah. I create it in secret, and I don't even release the Pinterest board publicly until the book has released. So I just put the Mount Laurel one up a few weeks ago.
Oh,
so.
That's fascinating. That's a very interesting, I think it makes sense, but because it's keeping it for you, you know?
Well, yeah, and it's probably full of spoilers, you know, on some level. On some level, there's spoilers in there. So.
Well, fascinating. We love learning. As you could tell, most of the questions were about yourself and your process and your the world of your writing more so than Mount Laurel itself. And I think that's as it should be because, yeah, number one, we're not here to spoil the book for anyone. But there's enough talk, there's enough meat in what we've discussed today about the time frame and a little bit of the character, and I think to whet people's appetites, to hopefully have them go out and get Mount Laurel to experience it for themselves. But thank you so much for your generosity, for sharing about your story and sharing about Mount Laurel and your process and things that kind of got you into this into your writing journey and inspired you, and for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you so much. Yes, I've very much enjoyed it. I'm always happy to talk about writing.
So I know that we've talked about it so much, I feel like we've talked about it, but I don't think we have. So why don't you give us, Lori, the elevator pitch for Mountain Laurel for those who have not read it yet?
Well, you know, the character's Ian. He's had a couple false starts in life, and he's but really his heart is to establish a life that's going to make his father proud, although, you know, he would settle for not ashamed. But in his newly adopted role as his planter uncle's heir, he finds himself at odds with the Southern acceptance of slavery. Clearly, he's going to need a force more compelling than his father's expectations to guide him through this web of kinship and oppression and just casual cruelty in which he finds himself entangled at Mountain Laurel. And Shauna is my other protagonist. She is an enslaved young woman at Mountain Laurel. As a slave, she really has few avenues of self-expression. And the one that she's found, drawing just on scraps of paper that she scrounges, it's been uncovered. And to Shauna's surprise, her master's nephew, Ian, not only keeps her secret, but encourages the endeavor. But opening herself to trust him, to trust Ian, in this one thing leads to complications and perils that Shauna could never foresee.
It's so funny. We talked about it and the preparation for it so much that I didn't realize we hadn't talked about it.
I know. Same here. I was like, oh, wait a minute.
Lori, what's the best way to find out more about Mountain Laurel, and how could someone go order it or get this book in their hands?
Well, you can find out about Mountain Laurel and all my books on my website at loribenton.com. You'll find bookseller links and you'll find all my social media links. You can sign up for my newsletter. So yeah, that would be the best place, loribenton.com.
Perfect. And as she shared earlier, she is on a lot of the social media mainstays such as Twitter, or I didn't hear you say Twitter, but you are on Twitter, correct?
I am. I'm on Twitter. I'm not the most active Twitter person, but Facebook,
no worries.
Facebook really is where I have an author page on Facebook, and the link is on my website, but that's where I post most of my writing news.
Now we all know where to find out the latest and greatest information about Lori, her latest work, and all of her books. And you can find links to all of her socials at loribenton.com. So Lori, again, a final and huge thanks for joining us here on the Outlander podcast. We are so thankful that you were here, and we look forward to your next endeavors.
Or the next installment in the Mountain Laurel.
There you go.
Series.
Thank you. Yep. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. You guys are delightful.
Well, thank you so much. And we look forward to all of what comes next.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.